From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, how the Nazi prison at Auschwitz, originally designed as a forced labor camp, became the site of history's largest mass murder. We talk with journalist Lawrence Rees, who's interviewed more than 100 Auschwitz survivors and Nazi perpetrators, many of whom spoke on the record for the first time. His book, Auschwitz, A New History, reveals fresh insights into the Nazi mentality. Rees has also interviewed war criminals from Imperial Japan and Stalinist Russia, and he said the Nazis were driven by a different kind of fanaticism. Also, critic at large John Powers has some thoughts on wine and globalization after watching the new documentary Mondo Vino. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. It might seem there's little left to be said about a subject as intensely studied as the Holocaust, but journalist Lawrence Reese's book, Auschwitz, A New History, presents both fresh information about the camp, the site of history's largest mass murder, as well as insights into Hitler's campaign of genocide against the Jews of Europe. Reese's book is based on more than 100 interviews with Auschwitz survivors and Nazi perpetrators, many of whom spoke on the record for the first time. He believes his search for the truth was aided by the fact that surviving Nazis have now reached an age where candor no longer jeopardizes careers, and by the fall of communism, which has opened up a wealth of new archival material. It's believed roughly 1.3 million people were imprisoned at Auschwitz. 1.1 million died there, despite the fact that it was not initially designed as a death camp, as some Nazi prisons were. Reese's book is in part the story of how Auschwitz evolved from a forced labor camp into a scene of mass extermination. Lawrence Reese has written 5 books and is creative director of history programs for the BBC. Auschwitz, A New History is the companion book to a 6-hour documentary which aired on PBS earlier this year. Reese recently spoke to me from London. Lawrence Reese, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You note early in this book that you were one of relatively few people who've been able to interview quite a number of war criminals from 3 of the great totalitarian powers of the 20th century, that is, Stalinist Russia, Imperial Japan, and Nazi Germany. And you say in this book that having done so, you can confirm that Nazi war criminals that you met were different from the other
That's
two.
That's right.
How were they different?
Well, they're different in a kind of paradoxical way, because when I grew up at school and first heard about the Nazis, and the whole line that was taken then in the 70s was that Nazi war criminals would give us a standard defense. Oh, I was acting under orders. And so that was kind of what you imagine when you meet people like this, they're going to say. Well, paradoxically, that was the kind of response I got from Stalin's secret policemen, from members of the Imperial Army who committed terrible crimes in China and in the Pacific War. That was what they were saying. I didn't tend to get that from Nazi war criminals. The frightening thing to me, particularly frightening, was that most of the Nazi war criminals I've met, actually, when you push them, say, why were you doing this? Don't say I was acting under orders. Say, well, at the time, I thought what I was doing was right.
And what do you attribute that to? I mean, they seem to be true believers in the cause.
I think it's a variety of things that in the end, for me, mean that Nazism is more horrible but more interesting as a phenomenon. I think it's to do with the fact that certainly if you were a secret policeman in Stalin's Russia, I think for the most part, the terror was so ubiquitous that no one was safe from the knock at the door. No one could really understand exactly why individuals were sometimes being targeted. Stalin famously had one of his own Politburo, Molotov's wife, tortured. I've talked to people who were at meetings where they were stood up and were denouncing other people as enemies of the state because they were worried they'd be denounced. There didn't seem to be a rhyme nor reason to some of this. So this means that the only way of making sense of it, really, for a lot of these people doing the bad things was to say, well, you know, I was doing it because I'm ordered to do it. Similarly, in Imperial Japan, the level of training, the brutality of the training of Japanese soldiers, I think is without parallel in the modern world, what these people were put through in training. The bullying, the vicious beatings and so on, the indoctrination as well. But it was such that if you didn't, you know, you obeyed, and you obeyed blindly, I think, in a number of cases. What's going on in Germany is rather different. What's going on in Germany is that I think, to some extent, thanks to the work of Goebbels, who, again, a horrible, nasty person, but the genius of propaganda of the 20th century, thanks to the work of Goebbels, but also thanks to the fact that there was a genuine feeling of injustice in Germany after the end of the First World War. There was a feeling put about that Jews were to blame. There was a feeling of fear of communism, that Jews were somehow falsely attributed in their totality to communism. Simultaneously, Jews were thought to be running Roosevelt and American politics anti-German and so on. So there were a whole series of what they took to be at the time pragmatic positive reasons to do what they were doing. And that's one of the frightening things about it.
You note that, Nazis were capable of initiative and even ingenuity in pursuing their goals, I mean, even when they involved mass murder. And you note that, Nazi commanders tended to tolerate internal questioning and even some dissent more than some other totalitarian regimes.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
what's the significance of that observation in judging the Nazi mentality?
Well, it means that, for a start, you can't do the traditional view of this, which is to think that you have some insane dictator at the top controlling all the levers of power who, by threat and bullying and coercion, is forcing people to do things against their will. That is simply not what is going on here. What is going on here is you have at the top someone who is setting a vision, an evil vision, of course, but a vision nonetheless, and other people are interpreting it and competing amongst each other to interpret it in a radical way and using their own initiatives to move towards what they think is the vision that their Führer wants. So you have a very complex structure of initiatives from below and vision from the top that together in the middle creates this.
Makes it terrifyingly effective.
Oh, it's the most, I think it's a way of ensuring that you have both the most destructive and dynamic political system. If you have a visionary who is saying, as he said, for example, to Arthur Greiser and Albert Foster, who are the two Gauleiters, the two rulers of two parts of Poland, he effectively said to them, look, I want that your areas of Poland Germanized, and I can only promise you one thing, which is I'll never ask you how you did it. As a kind of typical, it seems to me, Führer order to these people, which is there's a vision and, frankly, implementation, how you're going to do it, the area, what you choose to do, that's up to you to a large degree. And there's one overriding guideline you have in this if you're a subordinate in this system, which is you know that essentially your Führer is excited by radicalism. I don't believe that anyone's career in the Third Reich was ever hurt by coming up with an extraordinarily radical idea. You knew that the way to irritate him was to come up with reasons why things couldn't happen. So you had in, and then Hitler often appointed a couple of people, two or three people, to more or less the same job. So they knew, you know, it's almost a Darwinian competition. Hitler was a huge follower of social, of a kind of warped social Darwinianism. And you knew that there were maybe one or two other people also been charged with more or less the same task. So you had to do, you had to organize yourself pretty quickly, and you knew that the more radical you were, the more brutal you were in your approach, the more likely you were to find favor.
Now, when the Nazis spoke of achieving the final solution to the Jewish problem in the early years of the war, is it clear they meant extermination of the Jews?
No, they didn't mean extermination, then, I don't believe. It's clear that the words final solution change in meaning, I believe, during 1941. When Heydrich is charged by Goering with organizing the final solution to the Jewish problem, initially the order explicitly states evacuation. And that was the overt policy, certainly since 1938 and the Anschluss with Austria. When the German troops go into Austria, they, under Eichmann of the SS, of, you know, later absolutely infamous for being one of the organizers of the murders in the final solution, he organizes a system of expropriation, of robbing, of treating violently the Jews of Vienna, robbing them, and then those who can almost pay to go, expelling them. I think that what's clear is that Hitler always hated the Jews, he always loathed the Jews, he always wanted rid of the Jews in one way or another. The form that wanting rid of would take varied at different points. The final solution, therefore, varied, I think, at different points. And certainly at the beginning of the war, the final solution, I think, to the Jewish problem is one as they see it. I mean, horrible to use this language. It's not a problem. It's a Nazi problem. I mean, it's the problem of their mentality. But as they described it, the Jewish problem, the way to, quote, solve, unquote, this was by evacuation.
It's remarkable that you find places where people talk about the notion of mass killings as being uncivilized and un-German.
Yes. That's right. Both Heydrich and Himmler say that in 1940. And so we know, I think, beyond reasonable doubt, that the final solution does not mean extermination, because actually on paper, Himmler and Heydrich are talking about extermination as being uncivilized, when later on, openly, at his speech at Poznan in 1943, Himmler is talking about physical extermination. Something changes. And again, we know that from the documents that, and from eyewitness testimony, that in the summer of 1940, they had this, what it seems now at this distance, utterly outlandish, insane plan to transport Jews to Madagascar, the island of Madagascar off Africa. What they anticipated, the Nazis, was that the war was going to end in 1940. Britain would make peace, and they would have the French colonies at their disposal, including Madagascar, and the Jews would be able, in French ships, probably to be shipped there, which is why they were herded into ghettos. Ghettos were only ever seen as a temporary measure prior to expulsion. But again, as you see time and again in this terrible history, things don't go the way the Nazis want. They're constantly, really, they're almost constantly thinking the war's going to end. They keep thinking any minute now, any moment now, what, the war's going to stop. We'll have won and we'll be able to deal with this in this way. And it never does end when they think it's going to end.
Well, the development of this notion of a final solution from being the evacuation of Jews to the extermination of Jews, you sort of describe as a process of increasing radicalization. Now what does this mean?
If you go back to what I was saying earlier and you think, what's going to be the natural consequence of incredibly dynamic, incredibly competitive system of pushing towards a vision where you are trying to come up with the implementation policies and your only guideline is be radical? What's going to happen, I think, is what does happen, which is that you're going to have a series of horrific crises of your own making. So I think one of the best examples of this cumulative radicalization, of the Nazis responding brutally to crises that they themselves have created, occurs in the Lodz ghetto, where what happens is that the Jews have been imprisoned, they've been forced to give up their money to buy food, they run out of money, so they begin to starve. So then Nazi functionaries face a choice. Some say, let them all starve. Others say, no, we need to get something from these people, exploit them. That view prevails. They put them to work in horrible conditions, of course, and they pay them a tiny pittance, but those who are working can actually feed themselves a bit. Other people, the old people, children, are suffering terribly and still starving. And actually one Nazi functionary looks at this situation they themselves have created and writes a note saying, wouldn't it be more humane to kill these people rather than let them starve? So that's an example of how they end up in this position that they themselves have created, where someone has the obscenity to write that it's more humane to kill somebody than to leave them to starve.
So it's done with this utterly immoral idea of herding people into ghettos with the idea you will transport them out. When you can't transport them out, they begin to starve, and one thing leads to another, and then you've come to this bizarre, this utterly horrific conclusion that you have to kill people.
And so you see with exactly, and what's going on in the minds of a lot of these Nazis, unbelievably, we might think today, rightly, is a sense of annoyance and indignation that the Jews have brought this on themselves because the war's still going on and they can't be expelled. Well, so I've heard Nazis say and seen it that they say, oh, well, of course, Churchill's controlled by the Jews. That's why the British don't do the logical, sensible thing in 1940 and make peace with us. So we're still trapped in this war and we're in the war. As a result of what the Jews are doing. And if the war had ended, we'd been able to expel the Jews somewhere, where, incidentally, they would probably have had some form of genocidal horror awaiting them anyway, but they would have been expelled somewhere. And now we can't expel them. What are we supposed to do with them? And so this is the kind of mentality that you hear. And you see it absolutely plainly now, I think, as a result of a lot of new research around Pearl Harbor. That there are killings going on before Pearl Harbor, notably in Eastern Europe, in behind the lines in the war against the Soviet Union. But there's no major death camp in operation. But what happens is, as soon as Pearl Harbor happens, you see Hitler's rhetoric change, and he starts talking about, right, now it's a world war, and you remember my prophecy of 1939, in which he stated, if the Jews succeed in causing a world war, the result will be their annihilation. And I think, and a lot of some scholars that do that I agree with, some disagree, but this is the moment, but I certainly agree this is the moment, when actually he sees this as the prophet. He sees this as a fulfillment of a prophecy. He said, if the Jews get involved and cause a world war, America coming into the war is de facto a world war. They simultaneously think the Jews are not just behind Stalin, but they're behind Roosevelt as well. It's pathological, this stuff. But they absolutely believe that, I think. And so as a result of that, they absolutely push forward with a massive expansion in the killing around that time immediately after Pearl Harbor.
Journalist Lawrence Rees' book is Auschwitz, A New History. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is BBC journalist Lawrence Rees. His new book is Auschwitz, A New History. When the Nazis first began executing Jews in large numbers, they did it really with firing squads. What was the impact of that kind of close-quarter execution on the Germans who carried it out?
The impact for quite a substantial proportion of them was terrible. They were emotionally made distraught by this. They're having to shoot women and children at very close range. And this, thus, I believe, begins this journey to the gas chambers that we know of, the infamous gas chambers. And it's because we see when Himmler visits Minsk in August 1941, he's told of the emotional problems that the killing in this way, the shooting killings, are doing to his men. And he puts in train, as a result, a whole series of experiments to devise a way of killing that is not so emotionally disturbing to his men. So we have this terrible horror around this, don't we? That I'd always thought that the reason that the gas chambers were devised was primarily to kill people in large numbers. Well, it wasn't just that at all. It was actually so that there was a less emotionally stressful way that the killers could commit murder.
And they began initially by putting people into a cabin of some kind and piping exhaust fumes into it.
That's right. Well, what happens now, again, and we can see this as an example of both cumulative radicalism and competition within the Nazi state, is various people at various different locations come up with different initiatives. What happens is there's an initiative which is the gas van, which is a van where you connect the exhaust back into a compartment hermetically sealed in the rear where people are gassed. There's the building of camp at Belzec, which is the first stationary gas chambers. By stationary, I mean obviously not gas vans, but again using large engines with carbon gases going in to gas them. And then at the same time, in September 1941, you find a totally different initiative beginning at Auschwitz, which is the only camp where this initiative begins, which is the use of Zyklon B. Zyklon B is a powerful insecticide used for disinfecting rooms. And it was already in Auschwitz, and they used it for delousing prisoners' clothes and rooms because they had a terrible problem with lice because of the inhumane conditions, not least, that prisoners were kept in. And one of the functionaries there thinks to himself, well, it's got printed on Zyklon B cans, dangerous to life, don't go in the room while this is being let off. And he goes, well, actually, of course, if you want to kill people, they should be in the room. So he starts experimenting, not on Jews, but on the sick and on Soviet prisoners of war at Auschwitz. And he starts with Zyklon B. The experiments go wrong to start with. They alter doses, they do experiments, and eventually they evolve a different method of killing to the ones used in the death camps of Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec.
Now, as you noted, Auschwitz was not originally conceived of as a death camp, but as a labor camp, which meant that it was large and had lots and lots of barracks. And you note that when the killings of Jews really accelerated in 1942, that this was done not so much at Auschwitz, but at three other camps, at Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. And
yes,
they were specifically set up as death camps. And you made the point that when visitors go to those sites, they are always shocked at how small they are, even though these three camps alone accounted for 1.7 million deaths. Why were these deaths camps so small? How did they function?
Because they had no other function than killing. Auschwitz is unique in the history of the Nazi state. It's unique in the history of the world. It's not just the site of the largest mass murder the world's ever seen as a physical site. It's also unique in the Nazi state in that it's the only camp that combines two functions. It's both a concentration camp and a death camp. And those functions vary they vary at different times in its history. What's happening at places like Treblinka, Belzec and Sobibor is they are set up in 1942, all of them, open in 1942, they are set up purely to murder Jews. And if you plan on just murdering people, one of the shocking things is you need no real space at all. These places are a few hundred yards square. Nothing left of them now, because the Nazis themselves destroyed these camps in late 1943. They knew that they wanted to keep this secret. And they were essentially places where trains would arrive and the Jews would be taken off. And more than 99% of these people would be dead probably within 2 hours. So there was no stay of any kind really at all.
BBC journalist Lawrence Rees' book is Auschwitz, A New History. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine reports on how arts education is being used to boost student achievement in Texas schools, at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Auschwitz became a camp of mass extermination and why some Jews participated in the killing. We continue our conversation with Lawrence Rees, author of A New History of Auschwitz. Also, John Powers has some thoughts on wine and globalization after watching the new documentary, Mondovino. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Journalist Lawrence Rees' book, Auschwitz, A New History, is based on more than 100 interviews with Auschwitz survivors and Nazi perpetrators. The book is the companion to a 6-hour television series which aired on PBS earlier this year. When we left off, Rees was describing the difference between the sprawling site of Auschwitz, which was intended as a forced labor camp, and three smaller camps, including Treblinka, which were specifically designed for mass murder.
A camp like Treblinka, which was capable of killing 300,000 people in around less than 2 months in the summer of 1942, 300,000 people in that one small space. It was run by around 20 Germans and about 100 Ukrainian guards. And these Ukrainians had been mostly selected from prison camps. They had been people fighting on the Russian side who, in the horror of the prison camps that the Germans set up for these Russians, where millions died, were offered this chance of saving themselves to go and work on the German side. And then there was the third category of people working at these camps who were, tragically, Jews themselves. The Nazis selected, very occasionally from incoming transports, a number of fit Jewish people and forced them, on pain of their own immediate murder, to participate in the process by cutting people's hair, by showing the way to the gas chamber, by cleaning the gas chambers, by burning the bodies, and so on. And the torment that these people went through is scarcely imaginable.
So the actual horrific tasks of murder, of cleaning the bodies, of cleaning out the chambers after the killing has occurred is by and large not done by Germans.
Never done by Germans, really. No. Yeah.
And that was true at Auschwitz as well.
That's right. So they end up at the huge industrial-style killing factories of Auschwitz-Birkenau. You have a crematorium gas chamber complex that's capable in the summer of 1941 of killing 10,000 people in one day. And it's run by between 2 to 4 Germans and around about 100 Jews. Now, the Nazis save the absolute moment of murder to themselves. They're the ones who drop the canisters of Zyklon B actually into the gas chamber. But pretty much all the other tasks involved in making this operate are run by a Jewish Sonderkommando, who we know both from interviewing the few people who survived this and also from documents that Jewish Sonderkommando wrote and hid in the foundations of the building often at the time, that, as I say, the torment these people went through was practically indescribable.
I was struck by your description of the arrival buildings at the death camps, that they often were fairly pleasant looking, I mean, with flower plantings and the kind, I guess designed to reinsure the incoming inmates that their fate was not what it was going to be.
Again, this is all part of the cynicism, but it's also part of the learning curve that these Nazis go on. Because what happens at Treblinka, which was the most deadly, if you like, of all of these death camps outside of Auschwitz, what happened in the summer of 1941 is they were killing so many people that the system broke down. It's like summer of 1942 that the system broke down. There were bodies everywhere. There was just mayhem, people being shot. It was chaos. So they actually had to shut it down and reorganize it. And the new commander of Treblinka, what he managed to do as he pushed it forward was come up with all of these devices like the fake railway station, fake timetables, lovely flowers. Same thing happened at Sobibor. One of the most extraordinary individuals I've ever met, Toivy Blatt, who survived Sobibor, said actually when he got off there, he'd been expecting some horrible place. He said it was always beautiful. Flowers and the paths really nice and neat. And as you say, it's all designed so that when, say, Jews coming from Holland arrive, they're told, you were at a transit station, hygiene stop, while we just need to take a shower, have your hair cut, and we're going to move on east. And it's deliberately designed to do that.
Now, the mass killing in Auschwitz really began, I guess, when it was decided that the Germans would evacuate the Jews of Hungary. And then Auschwitz, in addition to being a labor camp, became the kind of factory of death which the other death camps were.
Well, there were Jews being killed en masse there from the spring of 1942, from the local area, from then Slovakia, French Jews were sent there and so on. But the actual mass period of frenzied killing, you're absolutely right, related to 1944.
You note that Auschwitz became really a death camp at a point when the Nazi death machine had become very well developed, and Nazi initiative and ingenuity had addressed some of the technical difficulties of mass murder and had worked out solutions. Tell us a bit about those arriving Jews who were selected for immediate death. What exactly faced them, and who did the work?
Well, they would be taken from the... By the time this became the most sophisticated procedure, they'd be taken straight from the arrival ramp, which was the area they arrived at directly inside Birkenau. The railway line ran right into the camp. They'd be taken really a few hundred yards round to one of four combination gas chamber crematoriums. They would then be taken down. In two cases of two of them, they'd be taken. Were on all on ground level. The other two, one had basement undressing rooms and gas chambers. They'd be taken down or into a room where they'd be told to undress, because they were going to have a shower as part of the camp's admittance procedure. And they would then be crammed into an airtight room, the door shut, locked behind them. And then either from above, in the case of the basement gas chambers, or through the windows of the ones all on the ground floor, canisters of Zyklon B would be thrown in. And it would take, dependent on how many people were in these gas chambers, dependent on the weather, because Zyklon B was more effective the warmer the air was, it would take 15, 20 minutes for these people to die a horrible death of suffocation and poisoning. The gas chambers would then be opened. The Sonderkommando, other Jewish prisoners with gas masks, would have to go in, would take out the bodies, would in the case of the adults go through them and take out the gold teeth, would shave the hair of the women. The bodies would then be pushed into lifts, taken up to the first to the ground level in the case of the basement gas chambers, where the bodies would be burnt, then their ashes would be collected and either thrown in the immediate area or taken down to the nearby River Vistula. So that was the horror of the process that they devised in the end.
Auschwitz was eventually liberated by the Red Army after many of the remaining inmates were forced on a death march, which out of the camp, which you describe in some detail. I was interested in the fate of the commander of Auschwitz, Rudolf Höss, who managed to escape and hide for a while, but was eventually captured. What became of him?
Well, what happened to him was that he was told by Himmler, his boss, in spring 1945, he was told to go run off and hide somewhere in the armed forces. And Höss, by all accounts, was disappointed by this. He'd been expecting some kind of dramatic end, not just to run off and hide, but he did as he was told, and he dressed up as a sailor and went off, and pretending to be a bosun, in fact, and hid on the holiday island of Zeelt in the Baltic as a sailor. And he was taken in by the British at the end of the war, and the British didn't bother to check whether he had an SS blood group number under his arm, which he did, but they didn't look. They thought he was a sailor, and they let him go.
What is that, an SS blood group number? What do you mean?
What happened was all members of the SS, well, actually not all, because interestingly enough, Dr. Mengele somehow managed to get around without one. But as a normal procedure of being admitted into the SS, you would have you would be given an SS tattoo, which contained information about your blood group, which was put under your arm. And the reason for that was because if you were injured and unconscious on the battlefront, they would know what blood group you were for blood transfusions. And they didn't do... It's the kind of information, I think, that's normally carried on dog tags with other soldiers. But the SS decided that it was better to be in a tattoo, which is in itself interesting, because Auschwitz was the only camp in the system that had tattoos. The other camps all had these dog tags that they gave to prisoners, but they put tattoos on people in Auschwitz because so many people were dying that the dog tags were getting taken off. They couldn't work out who was dead, who wasn't, tally it up on numbers. So they actually put the tattoo on people so that when they were dead, really, essentially, they could tell, they could, write them off their list. It's a kind of a weird paradox, isn't it, that that's also the tattoo. The other people who were tattooed there were the SS as well. But in any event, the British didn't look for the tattoo on Rudolf Höss. He was released. He went off and became a farmer. It was only after the British captured Belsen, Bergen-Belsen, that they, in the April 1945, that they began to hear about this man, Höss, in detail. Over several months, they interrogated prisoners from there, many of whom had come from Auschwitz. They learned a bit about Höss. They traced his family. And this was a very kind of clever way, I think, that the British intelligence services would find some of these people, which is it was always much easier to trace their family than them. And they worked on the basis that a lot of these people would be in touch with their family. So they put in prison Höss's wife and basically tricked her. They said, look, your children are going to go straight on this train here to the Soviet Union. We're going to hand them over to the Russians unless you tell us where your husband is. And she made a decision about who she wanted to protect most and wrote down the address where Hirst was hiding. So he was then captured, subsequently stood trial in Poland and was executed in 1947.
Journalist Lawrence Rees's book is Auschwitz, A New History. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is BBC journalist Lawrence Rees. His book is Auschwitz, A New History. Were many of the SS officials who conducted the murder at Auschwitz held accountable for their actions?
Well, I think this is one of the great scandals of this story, a story rich in scandal at every level, but this is one of the greatest scandals, which is that less than, well, maybe 12, 10% of SS people who worked at Auschwitz were ever prosecuted. Around 90% of the SS who worked at Auschwitz during the war escaped all forms of prosecution. And myself, I think that's a scandal.
Why was that?
One of the reasons that so few people were prosecuted was that by the 1960s, the German prosecutors had taken the view that unless a member of the SS was absolutely directly involved in the killing, or had been directly involved in acts of brutality, physical brutality, then they could get off scot-free. And, of course, it meant that the way that the gas chambers had been devised, which was that so few Germans were needed for their actual physical operation, it meant that the vast majority of SS at the camp could say, oh, I wasn't really directly involved in the killing at all. Now, myself, I think that's a calumny. That's terrible. Because, of course, if you're working in the currency units counting out money, if you're working in the SS transport division, if you're a guard at the camp, you are directly involved in the operation of the camp. That results, that's an extermination centre. So I certainly disagree with, for all the good it's going to do anybody that I disagree, but I certainly disagree that they took that view.
The irony is by having Jews themselves involved in the killing, they cleansed their hands and avoided prosecution in many cases.
Yes. It's like they didn't do, so it's kind of, if you're an SS man, you could cynically look at it, you won twice. You won once in that this whole place was operating and you weren't actually having to get your hands dirty with the murder because they'd organised this system whereby you didn't have to. And secondly, that then became the reason you weren't prosecuted. It's a scandal, I think.
In this book, you compare the crimes of the Holocaust to other mass exterminations in history, going as far back as Genghis Khan's genocide in Persia, and conclude that this represents the lowest act in human history and should not be allowed to recede into distant memory as some of these other mass killings have. What's different about this extermination?
I think that if you're looking at how you should think about events in the past, or even events in the present, actually, what you've got to do is look at the overall circumstances in which these things happen. It's not much good thinking, well, oh, the Vikings were terrible. Well, the Vikings operated in a system of values at the time that was, they were, by all accounts from latest research on Vikings, for example, scarcely better or worse than any other 10th-century marauding hordes. I mean, it's a ludicrous, seems to me, a ludicrous way to go to start blaming Vikings for being Vikings. Something different is going on here. What's happening is that you're taking a cultured nation at the heart of Europe in the 20th century, long after the Enlightenment, that has adopted absolute civilized cultural values in the wake of the end of the First World War. It is a thriving, although troubled, democracy. It's got rid of all legislation against Jews. It's liberal in that regard. All of these things are going on. It's got a great written culture. It's got a great musical culture. It's got a great artistic culture. It's the place you would think would be the most civilized almost to be. And yet that very place, within a matter of years, turns into this. So you've got a journey that they go on that's unlike any. It's not like the journey the Vikings go on, or Genghis Khan, the plains goes on. This is not like that. This is a different journey. This is a journey from one pole, one extreme, if you like, to the other extreme. And in the process, they use 20th century technology that they warp and adapt to this very service of mass killing. And unlike Stalin, who even at his worst, when he was deporting entire nations, the Kalmyk nations, the Crimean Tartars and so on, he's deporting whole nations to Siberia. Even Stalin isn't trying to put forward measures to eliminate them in their entirety. So something different, I think, is going on here.
So many students of Nazism and the Holocaust have tried to, in some way, answer the question, how could this happen? You've interviewed 100 or so survivors and war criminals from Auschwitz. Do you feel you have some new insights into that question?
I think what surprised me about this, and because I never intended this career, like it's kind of happened to me, you know, that I've been written so much on this and made so many programs on this. And one of the reasons it's happened is because I keep thinking I'm getting close to being able to answer that properly. And as I keep getting towards it, it keeps going away from me a bit more. So I think I'm a long way down the road, I hope, to being able to get to there. But I'm not there yet. Maybe it's absolutely impossible to get there. But one thing I took from this was a big fear I've now got about people of absolute faith. I always thought faith of itself was it could only be a positive thing. Everyone talks about the importance of having faith. Well, these guys had faith, absolute faith. And there's one really desperately upsetting, all desperately upsetting, but ideologically there's one desperately, particularly upsetting moment where in the book where I talk about how Himmler and Höss most admired as prisoners Jehovah's Witnesses. They pointed to them and said, see that faith, that's the kind of faith we need in our Führer. Absolute, unshakable faith. Now, of course, no one is equating what the Nazis did with Jehovah's Witnesses or who operate a whole creed of peace and love and so on. Absolutely. But the very notion of absolute faith is at the core of this. And so I'm beginning to start to have questions about people who or communities that are absolutely certain about things.
Well, Lawrence Rees, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
BBC journalist Lawrence Rees. His book, Auschwitz, A New History, is the companion to a 6-hour television documentary which aired earlier this year on PBS. The Steve Reich composition, Different Trains, was inspired by memories of his childhood. His parents were separated. His mother moved to Los Angeles while his father stayed in New York. From 1939 to 1942, Reich traveled back and forth by train between his parents. He writes, while these trips were exciting and romantic at the time, I now look back and think that if I'd been in Europe during this period, as a Jew, I would have had to ride very different trains. Here's an excerpt from the first movement of Reich's Different Trains, which includes the voice of his governess, Virginia, who accompanied him on these trips.
Thank you. fastest train.
An excerpt from the Steve Reich composition, Different Trains. Coming up, critic at large John Powers on wine, globalization, and the documentary Mondo Vino. This is Fresh Air. Globalization in the wine industry is the subject of Mondo Vino, a controversial new documentary by Jonathan Nossiter. Our critic at large, John Powers, has some thoughts on what's lost and what may be gained when cultural traditions come up against a market-driven world economy.
A few weeks ago, I was visiting Hong Kong and met a woman who'd been coming to that city for decades. She'd just spent the afternoon wandering around the central downtown district, looking for the traditional shops and butchers she once loved. She was horrified to see how many of the old places have been replaced by Starbucks outlets and international stores like Armani. She blamed globalization for flattening world culture. Every city, she grumbled, is becoming the same city. I thought about her words as I watched Mondo Vino, a fascinating new documentary by Jonathan Nossiter that has wine people in a dither. The movie is all about the globalizing wine business. You see, winemakers once turned out wines linked to their communities. Each wine embodied a unique terroir, the almost mystical union of a particular soil, a particular climate, a particular grape, even a particular cast of the sun. It was the end of the natural process celebrated by Virginia Madsen's great monologue in Sideways. But these days, as Nossiter shows, winemaking is increasingly ruled by billionaire modernizers like California's Mondavi family. They've snapped up old wineries and used such aging tricks as micro-oxygenation to produce an increasingly homogenized product. Terroir has been replaced by technique. Crusty old grape growers have been supplanted by consultants who flit from vineyard to vineyard, explaining how to tool their wines for international tastes. And these tastes have been hugely shaped by the Alan Greenspan of the international wine market, Maryland-born critic Robert Parker. Parker's ratings can't merely make or break a label. They actually lead international winemakers to alter their products in hopes of satisfying the critics' fondness for so-called fruit bombs. Naturally, Parker himself thinks he's just trying to make the world better, even seeing his success as something of a social breakthrough.
What I'm very proud of is that I think that I brought up an American point of view to this sort of elitist beverage. And particularly in France, I suppose, where there's so much invested with these old families that many of them go back to pre-revolutionary times and have these noble estates and this incredible heritage and history. And here comes this American who comes over and calls your wine a casual picnic wine and rates some upstart neighbor that's making in my palate, a better wine, gives it a better review. This is incredibly unnerving.
Of course, Parker's detractors view things very differently. They see him as a metaphor for the larger process of globalization, homogenization, and shudder, Americanization. Parker's particular tastes, reinforced by American technique and marketing, have narrowed the range of wines, pushing them toward a generic international standard. Friends of mine who are enophiles, to use an ungainly term for wine nuts, rail against Parker's influence. One even told me he'd rather drink an expensive but disappointing Burgundy than any micro-oxygenated product, no matter how tasty. For him, part of the whole pleasure of wine lies in the diversity of different vintages, different landscapes, different wine cultures. I understood his feeling. As a film critic, I often complain about the way Hollywood's power has crippled other countries' film industries, leading them to ape American-style filmmaking. These days, seemingly every country in the world makes hip movies about hitmen. And if that were the whole story, then the anti-globalizers would be absolutely right. The world is being leveled, reduced. But in fact, things aren't nearly so simple. Truth is, globalization is a question of trade-offs, and these trade-offs often pit our ideals against one another. Take me. I'm all for diversity. I'm as suspicious of corporations as I am of big government. I favor small local shops over today's big boxes. But at the same time, I'm equally in favor of democratized culture. I'm all for Martha Stewart bringing nicely designed products to Kmart. I've bought them. I may complain that Hong Kong is now overrun by Starbucks, but millions of locals are happy with the prosperity it signals. And I couldn't even complain about how Hong Kong isn't what it used to be were it not for democratized mass tourism, which let me buy a cheap ticket. Which brings us back to wine. Mondavino is right that there was something glorious about the old tradition of making wine. Yet it gives short shrift to the one big thing that must be said for the new globalized wine biz. Ordinary people can now afford to drink a quality of wine that was once only enjoyed by the elite. The bottle we buy for $10 is more reliably good than ever before, in part thanks to Parker's celebration of big flavor and Mondavi-style mass marketing. Sure, it may be micro-oxygenated to please mass taste, but frankly, most of us, being part of the masses, won't notice or care. It tastes good. And even if drinking it means we're flattening out the world, at least we have something pleasurable to dull the pain.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A fanatic who organized the slaughter of five unarmed settlers, abolitionist John Brown is considered by many to be a 19th century terrorist. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Reynolds, who's written a new biography. Also a conversation with actor David Duchovny on The X-Files, his understated style, his days at Yale, and his new film. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.